This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
I wonder if you've noticed when you're watching a movie or perhaps TV that something feels a little different, perhaps, in the way that people look, because faces that crease, faces that move, faces that tell stories and not just pose for photos are back. So for years, we've been surrounded by one narrow idea of beauty, smooth, symmetrical, interchangeable. But suddenly, that sameness feels a little unsettling. So are we watching the start of a backlash? And if we are, what does that say about how we read each other and ourselves?
Gender, sexuality, and pop culture. There isn't much Lauren Rosewarne doesn't know, and if she doesn't, we'll make it up.
Good afternoon, Lauren Rosewarne.
Hello, Warren. Thanks for having me.
When you watch a movie or TV now, what's the first thing you notice about faces that actually move?
Yeah, look, I think I have noticed a leaning, at least it could be because of the shows I choose to watch, but I'm thinking of The Diplomat recently, as well as The Beast in Me. One has Kerry Russell, one has Claire Danes, women who are kind of around my age, a little bit older than me, but around about my age. And I've noticed that these are women who are allowed to age on screen. They may have had cosmetic procedures, but it doesn't look like it. And yes, there's been a bit of a backlash online that they're looking their age, but they've also got really expressive faces. You know, there was a whole Twitter account devoted to Claire Danes' chin and this idea that she acts with her chin. And it's gotten a lot of attention because the argument is that for a while we got quite used to women's faces not being particularly expressive because of things like Botox and other cosmetic interventions that really limited the mobility of the face.
Are many of the cosmetic interventions that did limit that ability, are they permanent? Are we going to leave some women behind?
Look, I mean, this has always been the case with any intervention, regardless, be it weight loss injections, Botox, whatever it might be. At the moment, there's always a class issue at play. This is not about what it looks like to age for every woman. It's part of that reason when you point to why doesn't every, I don't know, woman in her 70s look like Helen Mirren or whatever it is. And it's like, well, a lot of money goes into looking that good, or at least to look like that. I shouldn't use the word good. It's good's complicated, but to looking like that at that age. So yes, there's always going to be women who can't afford these procedures. But there is also the other aspect of this, whether this is also a choice that can be made now. And I think that's where I like this story more. Less about pressure to have surgical interventions or cosmetic interventions or not, but or demonizing women who've had them, because that's not helpful either, but rather saying there are options, that you're going to see some women who look their age, some who don't, who defy their age, and both are okay. Because I think that feels more realistic than judging women's choices, because that's always been the case. Whether you've had a procedure or you've let yourself go, either way, there's going to be criticism, and I'd like it to be less spoken about, full stop.
I feel like, I mean, facial expression is such a huge part of communication, isn't it? And I'm wondering how we'll start to see the movies more. Will we connect with them more emotionally if we start to see the actors on screen showing their expressions and their facial expressions?
And I think this is one of those things that it depends on the audience, because some will look at, you know, Claire Danes' supposed chin acting and think, God, she conveys a lot with her face, right? And that some people will see that as a good thing. Other people will look at that and find it really distracting. I remember with Claire Danes specifically, my brother sent me a video of sort of her chin acting, and he said, every time I see her, this is what she's doing. And he reads it as overacting. And this is that also sort of subjectivity of facial expressions as well, where, you know, is a lot of facial movement seen by some audiences as exaggerated motions as well. And I think this is part of that conversation. Not everybody interprets gestures and facial expressions the same way. I think another component of this story is also the increasing likelihood we're going to see more AI images and what that does to us in terms of conveying real. Do we want our AI to look very human, or do we want it to look more animated so that we can have that emotional distance? The jury's out yet because we're seeing both.
I mean, I would love to see it a little bit different so that we can tell the difference, of course.
Yeah, and the difference, though, has to be quite substantial. So that, I think we've spoken about the concept of uncanny valley before, but uncanny valley is this psychological phenomenon that talks about when an image is human-like but only a tiny bit different. So think hyperreal animation as an example. Audiences find it unsettling. There's a Christmas film with Tom Hanks, which was criticized, like something, the Polar Express, which was really criticized for this because it was so like live action, yet was still animated. Audiences felt it was a bit jarring. Why not one or the other? And I think that's going to be the question with AI. Are you going to make it basically human and unsettle us, or are you going to go at least down the path of it making it look like it's animated because our brain can then process that as fake, as opposed to us having to do that calculation of what are we actually looking at?
Lauren, you can tell you're the academic because you brought up Tom Hanks in the Christmas movie. I'm going to bring up the moon in Mr. Squiggle, because I don't know why that comes to mind. Was it the moon that didn't have any facial expression? It was just eyes? I don't know why I'm getting it.
I can picture Mr. Squiggle. I just can't picture the moon.
I'm sure there was a moon. Someone, okay, 0427 569 949. Was there a moon? Because with a face, and the face, the mouth moved, and it had eyes, but I don't think it had the full facial expression. I don't know why I'm getting it.
Okay. I've just Googled it and nothing is coming up, but I'll do a deeper dive, Warren. I'm willing to trust you.
I don't know. It was something anyway.
But yeah. it is a good example, though, where humans also, and this is apparently a survival instinct, we also see faces in inanimate objects. It's part of that reason you'll see sort of sometimes washing machines will look like they've got a face. Our brains kind of organize this around it. But at least there we can see a face but still recognize it's not human. And this is where that uncanny valley is, where it's, we can't actually work out, are we looking at something real or are we looking something fake?
I'm a good toasted sandwich maker. There might be a face on my toasted sandwich.
Have a look. People, there's entire social media groups devoted to this, is people seeing faces. Think cars, for example. Often the headlights will resemble, again, it could be something that, you know, like the people who look at clouds. I can never see things in clouds, but I can definitely see faces in inanimate objects. Now, I'm like a hunter at heart.
You know, my barber I go to, you know, he puts the chair flat and I look up and while he does the shaving of the neck, and I swear I can see figures in the wood, you know, in the grain of the wood on the ceiling, and I've named them all. They think it's hilarious, but, you know, there's a whole family
up there. I think, though, that this is something that brains do like to put patterns together, you know, things that are abstract or ad hoc, we try, and particularly if you stare at something for a long time. My grandparents had these tiles that had this kind of marbled pattern in it, and we all saw a different animal in it. And for me, it was the chicken tiles.
Chicken tiles. Lots of SMSs coming in. It was the blackboard. I think you're thinking of the blackboard and Mr. Squiggle, who used to say, hurry up all the time.
The blackboard absolutely comes up.
Yes, the blackboard. I don't know why I thought the moon. The blackboard, and his mouth just moved. His eyes didn't. That's from Dr. Jane and Glenn Waverley. And also, thank you so
much. Which does remind me of Mully Grubbs. I don't know if you remembered Mully Grubbs. It was one of the commercial networks, and it was just a sort of disembodied mouth and eyes, and it was very creepy. And kids of a certain age, basically my age, are haunted by that because it was just this very weird kind of, floating face without most of the features. Odd.
Lauren, why is it that, you know, we criticise people because, you know, they may not have certain beauty standards, but we're not saying, okay, this is great for readability. You know, why does it matter that we can, you know, clearly not read emotion in someone that's had these things? And I'm not shaming anyone who has it, but what's wrong with not doing it and being expressive and having a readable face as well? Why are these people being criticised? What does that say about us?
We're merging the idea, which is the long-standing beauty standards that have existed in our culture, where women's value, more so than men, is disproportionately connected to how attractive we find them. And attractiveness has been bound up for a really long time with youth. And youth means you're going to have an unlined face, you're going to not have laugh lines and too many crinkles on your forehead. And therefore, that is perceived as a good-looking woman. That's who we're going to find attractive. And if you don't look like that, if you start to look older, then you're in other roles that aren't sort of the sex objects. And I think this is part of this story of, again, roles for women that are separate from them being eye candy. And also that idea that we're that women are on screen for their ability to tell a story rather than look good. And there has been a really long history of women on screen whose primary role is there to just look good. And in our, you know, long history of Western beauty standards, looking good has always been looking young.
Lots more messages coming in saying, Blackboard, hurry up.
Hurry up. Now it's all coming back to me.
There's a song about that. We might have to find Celine Dion. Now, is this, firstly, we're chatting with Associate Professor Lauren Rose-Warren from the University of Melbourne about whether we're finally pushing back against facial conformity and why real expressive faces matter. Now, is this shift about rejecting cosmetic work altogether, or is it more about rejecting the pressure to erase identity?
So there's been some trends. I recall last year a study came out that said that some of the more drastic, if you like, cosmetic interventions, things like that fat removal for that muscle under the chin that gave women a very kind of sort of sculpted and if not some cases gaunt look, I think it's buccal fat removal, that trend had faded now and that women were re-embracing a sort of, you know, more plump face. Again, this idea of trends, it always comes and goes. We like, you know, super inflated lips and suddenly we don't like them anymore. And that's, I think, the sort of commercialism and capitalism that's at play with these things. I don't think the pressure on women and the pressure on people in general to look good and look young within these really narrow bands is going to go away entirely. I just like to think that we're going to see some more women who are older and actually allowed to look their age on screen being more normal. I think that's probably where we'll get to. And that comes with seeing women in their 40s, 50s and older actually looking their age and not trying to look 25.
This one from Simo says, well, I can't see your facial expression right now, Warren. Have you had work done? No, my
face
moves.
We both have. Warren and I get injected every single weekend at the salon.
Well, you know what? That's why I do radio. Whereas now, you know, it's acceptable. We can go and do TV.
Exactly. We both have the face for radio.
Now, social media, though, I mean, it's trained us, hasn't it, to think of faces as images. What happens, you know, what would have happened if we forget that faces are actually social instruments as well? Like, are we going to potentially have a whole generation of people who don't know how to read people?
Well, this is actually part of the, if you look at the research that led to the social media ban for young people, part of the motivation of that was studies around young people's beauty image or self-image and feeling as though they can't possibly compare to all of the very, very filtered images that they were seeing of their friends. And that idea of particularly even non-teenagers, these studies came out after COVID where everybody was doing all their meetings on Zoom, and this idea of using filters. And then what do we have to do when we have to go back in real life and see the horror of everybody's real life faces? And I think this is one of those things where we've had to adjust the idea that there is a very different self that presented online compared to in real life, and neither is necessarily more real because one is the chosen face rather than, you know, identity gets played with a lot more today than perhaps at any other time, but that perhaps that's okay, that we just have to balance, kind of like media literacy, where we have to be constantly aware that some stuff is real and some is fake. We have to do the same sort of brain calisthenics when we're thinking about appearance as well. And I think this is part of that reason with online dating as well, where people are so thoroughly disappointed by the person that they match with. This is again that idea that people have one self in their mind versus their real self.
I was walking across one of the parks today in Melbourne, and there was someone coming in the other direction, and you know, I'm just casually, not even conscious of, but I watched them stop and put on a completely different face, take a selfie, you know, do the two fingers in the air thing, and the face looked totally different, and then it went back. This person went back to themselves, and they looked fine anyway. But I was thinking afterwards, I thought, wow, I'll talk to Lauren about this, because that image would have gone out that I look like this. But I can tell you, it wasn't the same person.
And this is an entire topic that we could probably spend half an hour on.
I love it.
Because it's, again, it's part of the reason I don't have photos around of anybody, because I always have this thing of when you pose, that's a completely contrived moment.
It is.
And it feels funny when I look at those. Anyway, I'm just not a selfie taker because of that. I'd rather people see my misery 24/7 than faking it.
Lauren, I love it. I love our miserable chats. It's so much fun. Thanks for joining us. And
I look forward to talking next week.
Thank you. That's Associate.
Thanks, Lauren.
Thanks, Associate Professor Lauren Rosewarne from the University of Melbourne.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.